Welcome to an update, a report actually, from Shake 33 Tour with Warren Pohl. Warren, where are you located?
Well, Don Freeman, I believe you are in Studio G there, is that correct?
I am, sir, in Studio G. And what studio might you be?
I might be in studio of the 33 Shake van parked up in a parking lot somewhere in northern San Diego with shoppers wandering past, kind of looking at me a bit weird.
So, Warren, last we spoke, we talked about making 3.3 observations, and we'd call and kind of catch up with you, find out what you're discovering in your tour of America on this 33 Shake mission.
Yeah, we are having our eyes well and truly opened. It is a baptism of fire into your country here. We've been here before, obviously, as tourists and occasionally with our previous careers, but they've been short trips. This time we are literally being thrown in at the deep end and going, right, you're in America now, and let's see what these strange European eyes of ours can see. One of the first things that came to me is number one at the top of my list, four words. Your trails are dangerous.
What is so dangerous about our trails?
My God. We have met so many great people, and a lot of them obviously say, hey, let's go running. And one of our rules is if someone asks us if we want to go running, the answer is always yes. We went up into the San Gabriel Mountains a week or so ago, and we're running along in this glorious single track. Drops of several hundred feet, just right inches away from our feet. If you trip on a rock going downhill, you are not going to land on your face. You're going to land 600 feet below in a bush. So we thought that's pretty edgy. I like that. Then we were in Oregon at one point. The rattlesnakes started to appear there, and I think they're just about everywhere, it seems, down here. We were in the middle of nowhere. We thought, oh, this is a nice spot for a picnic. And the only house anywhere near, this guy came running out and shouting at us. And when we could finally hear what he said was, rattlesnakes! And so we had to stop our picnic. Back at home, what do we get? You go to Scotland, you get some pretty angry little midges. They're tiny little flying things that, they're not even poisonous, they're just annoying.
What was that called, a nitchie?
A midge, M-I-D-G-E, just a little tiny flying insect. They fly in clouds, and they kind of have a little nip at you. It's not a bite. It's not a poison. It's nothing. You run through London, you might get an energetic squirrel, like, runs past you, but that's it. You've got proper wildlife and proper drops and everything, and, you know, there are bears out there and things like that, and you guys all think it's normal. Which is brilliant because people go, yeah, hey, do you remember that trail we saw the bears on and when Dave nearly fell in the canyon and lost his leg? Anyway, hey, who's coming running? I absolutely love it.
Well, you know, it is the Wild West.
Do you have snakes in England? I know they don't in Australia or New Zealand, one of those countries down there. They don't have snakes, but do you guys have snakes?
We do, but they're like, we do not have wild or dangerous animals, period.
What,
basically, that's it.
They're pet snakes? What do you mean they're not wild? I think all snakes are wild.
They are wild. I get they're not dangerous. What I mean is they are small, inconspicuous grass snakes that, I mean, I've lived in the UK all my life. I've traveled all over it. I've been running in the wilderness. I spent a lot of time outdoors. I've never seen one outside of a zoo.
So that's observation number one.
Trails are dangerous.
Trails are dangerous. Let's move to number two, Warren.
Well, it's another four words, and it's your weather, because I know the English always talk about the weather, so we're going to do that. But your weather is dangerous as well, like properly dangerous, and that's normal. I mean, we only need 6 inches of snow, and the country grinds to a halt. It makes the national news when, like, a couple of houses get flooded and someone had to kayak down the main street of a village. And that happens once a year. Over here, like, as far as I can tell, I think half of Texas has been underwater. The guy in our motel in Winnemucca, he came to warn us that if we're going through Oklahoma and places, we should just look out for the tornadoes. And then we asked him, well, what do we do if we see one? And he was a bit less clear at that point. It's just like, well, you're going through it. Okay, we've seen one. What do we do? Well, nothing, really. You just hope it doesn't swallow you up and take you into the sky. So, we just don't. We have weather, obviously, but it's all in a very narrow band. It very rarely gets treacherous. Here, treacherous seems pretty normal. Are we right, or are we just freaked out Europeans?
You're absolutely right. The fun thing about the United States is, since it's so big, there's so many different types of weather. I saw a post our friend Billy Yang was talking about. You know, he lives in Southern California, and he was looking at this tornado, or he was at a tornado or saw a tornado or something. He said, "Hey, I'll take an earthquake any day over a tornado." So,
do you have earthquakes over there in England?
Again, not really. I think once in the last 30 years, like, someone's cup of water might have got spilt, and that would have made the news because there was a tremor. But no, we don't. Buildings don't fall down unless they've been badly built. We don't have earthquakes. That's it. If we had an earthquake, something has gone very wrong in the UK.
So we have dangerous trails. We have treacherous weather. And the third mention of your observations from the 33 Shake tour, where you and Erica, the founders of 33 Shake, are spreading, much like Johnny Appleseed, spreading the chia seed throughout the United States.
The modern day Johnny Appleseed. I love it.
We are Erica and Warren chia seed. I don't know if it will catch on the same way, but, you know, we can try it. Number three is a medal is danger, disaster, calamity awaiting round every corner. My God, you guys are friendly. And you know, that whether that's people talking to you at the gas station or just in the street, or saying, "Hey, come and stay in our house," when they don't know us at all, or even, you know, in the case of one guy, this lovely guy, John Bryant, his kids slept upstairs while we got their rooms downstairs. I really couldn't believe that one. Just so much hospitality, welcome, and sort of open, easygoing conversation with people you've never met. And if we take that back to London, I mean, literally, you can get on the tube in London in the morning. The only time people talk on the tube, it's quieter than a library. You can put like 1,000 people on a tube train. No one says anything. Everyone avoids eye contact. The only time they speak is after 11 p.m. on a Friday or Saturday night when they're drunk. And that next morning, the same people will ignore each other. They can get on the same train every day for 20 years, and they will ignore each other. If we take that back, this kind of just going up and talking to people, "Hey, how are you doing? What's going on?" We will probably be locked up in a week, I think.
Warren, if you guys would speak a little bit more, your language would catch up to ours. See, ours has evolved because we use it. You're still back in the old country.
That is the problem. This is why yours is so much more streamlined.
I was going to say, the reason why people are talking to you and being nice to you is because you have Erica with you.
Do you think that's what it is?
Absolutely. Well,
I'm afraid that has a great deal to do with this.
Once people see Erica, they say, "Oh, we'll do anything for you, Warren."
Well, it's funny how, actually, now you mention it, a lot of the time they are talking to her.
Yeah, well.
But I'm just sort of allowing that to rub off on me.
So to keep in the theme of 33, we have 3.3 observations. What's your point three?
Point three is in 4,000 miles and I think 7 states now, we haven't met anyone who wants to vote for Donald Trump. Where are these people? I mean, has he really upset runners somewhere? Because apparently he's taking over the world. And I don't want to add to his media bandwagon by talking about him, but we've spoken to a lot of people across a broad spectrum, I'd like to think, across a large chunk of your country, and no one is voting for him. What's going on?
Here's the problem, Warren. No one says or admits that they're going to vote for him.
it's a safer position, yes. That's why we have private voting booths.
There's a curtain on that voting booth.
Are you saying that our straw poll may not match results?
Oh, I'm afraid that's what we're all finding out. Warren, let's...
Well,
go ahead. You finish your comment, and I'm ready to chime in.
No, I'm going to say, let's see where it all falls in November. It's quite the storm.
Yes, yes. In fact, everything is bigger over here in America. To fit your theme, even the political race seems to have a bit of embellishment. So let's keep track of one another. Let's contact each other next week and get 3.3 more observations of from the tour, from the European eyes of the United States. How does that sound?
That would be absolutely wonderful. We're having a ball here, and by then we will have headed significantly further east. So everyone keeps telling us things are going to change, and we're looking forward to those changes.
And they do.
So I have one last question in two parts. One is, how is your fitness level? Are you finding that you're getting enough running in with all these groups of people that your fitness level is improving? And the second one is somewhat related. How's that van doing after 4,000 miles?
Oh, yes.
Okay, so personal fitness seems to be holding up. I don't know if it's improved. One of my aims is to improve it by the end of this trip, despite being on the road, no gym, no fixed itinerary. And that is a challenge. But judging by the tests from my Polar Watch, I'm where I was when the trip started. So my fitness tests are giving the same results, and I'm running the same pace over the same sort of distances. So that's feeling pretty good. Van fitness is the dog smell is nearly gone. That's the big one. We managed to sleep in this van in the desert when we were in Phoenix, and we didn't get ostracized as the smelly dog people the next day. So I think that odor is nearly gone. Other than that, I don't want to tempt fate too much, but she's holding up like a beauty.
Awesome. You know, and that smell, you may just become accustomed to it. I'm afraid that it might still be there. I'm not sure. You'll need to get a fresh nose, someone to go out there and make a judgment.
Well, maybe we need one of your representatives heading further east, and they can stick a head in it, and maybe Andy Jones-Wilkins as we get through there, and he can tell us what he really thinks. But I think it's nearly gone. I'm hopeful we are nearly clear of the. Wow, I don't know what dogs they were, but there were a lot of them, and they lived in here, I think.
Well, we just hope that smell goes away by the time it's time to resell that van on the market on the East Coast.
I tell you what, the fame has spread. People, one of the first questions we get from some people, the conversation goes like this. Oh, 33 Shake, heard you on Trail Runner Nation. How bad's that dog smell?
Well, if you don't know what 33 Shake is, Google it. It's 33shake.com. Erica and Warren are some of the owners of this company. They're going across America trying to educate and show what good nutrition should be on the trail. You can go on there and find out how to order some. You can also go on there and find out how you can invite Warren and Erica to stay in your home and kick your kids out of their bedrooms.
That's at 33shake.com.
It is, and just a reminder, we do have that discount code set up for all Trail Runner Nation listeners. It's TRN33, TRN33, gets you 10% off your order on our website.
Until next week, Warren Paul, thank you very much.
Looking forward to it. Pleasure as ever. Have a great day there, guys.
Hey, Scott, what do you notice about my face today?
You know, it looks kissable.
Well, I hope not by you, but I'm glad it does look kissable. That's because I shaved with Harry's.
You know, I have been shaving with Harry's ever since we got these, probably a year and a half ago.
I'm with you, Scott. I walk into a crowded room, and I just feel like I belong.
Do you think people notice that you're a Harry's man?
A Harry's man. You know, I've heard people whisper behind me, and I'm certain they're talking about my shave. Yes.
We've talked for many times about the post-shave balm.
A Harry's man. Are you kidding me, Scott?
The post-shave balm. It's one of my favorite things after shaving. I get out of the shower. I shave in the shower.
Sure. Shower
and
shaver.
And I just put two and a half, sometimes three pumps on. Put it all over my face and the extra I put on my arm. I just love that stuff.
How much do I love it? It's at the end. I have another bottle waiting because I always have one in reserve, but I will still turn it upside down, open it up, take it off the pump little mechanism, and just, it's luxurious.
It is. One of the other nice things is on the Truman set, which is their introductory set that you can buy, is they've listened to their customers, and now instead of it being kind of a hard plastic, it's a little bit rubberized, so us shower shavers don't drop it.
Well, you don't want to drop your soap or your razor.
So with all of this, you're thinking, man, you know, Don and Scott have been talking about Harry's for a long time. That's got to be pretty expensive. It's not, Don.
$10 will get you a Harry's razor on your doorstep. That
delivered
includes shipping.
Includes shipping. I don't know how they do it.
Well, because they care. That's why.
So if you go to harrys.com and enter the code TRN, you get a $5 off. So you can get that Truman set for $10.
Do it. And become a Harry's man.
Ladies and gentlemen of the wide, worldwide ultra running community, you are listening to nothing less than the greatest Trail Running Nation podcast on earth. It is the Trail Runner Nation podcast.
This might be one of the most interesting podcasts ever.
Oh, that's what you're doing. There's a bunch of like old brothel hookers like buried out here.
No, I've listened to your podcast for many years, and it's
I do own my own bar. every Friday morning on I Run Far, we open up and open up the taps.
You record this, aren't you, Freeman?
I get everything. Thanks for joining another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name is Scott Warr.
And I'm Don Freeman, and we're here with I Run Far, and that's a name that you've heard many, many times, and the man behind it is Brian Powell. And there is just so much coverage on the day, race day. If you want to know what's happening at Leadville, you want to know what's happening at Western States, or race across the globe over, it doesn't matter, UTMB, it's I Run Far that's on the trail, giving you live updates as it rolls out. So thank you very much for those that report and those efforts. And I want to talk a little bit about that, Brian, about some of your coverage in these races a little further in this podcast. But today we're featuring his new book. Scott, you've got one in your hand.
I do. It's called Where the Road Ends. And this is co-authored, I should say there's a subtitle, Where the Road Ends, A Guide to Trail Running. This is by Brian and Megan Hicks.
Awesome. So you have another book, Relentless Forward Motion.
Yeah, I love that title.
And what compelled you to write this book, Brian, and what's different about it as we pick this new version up? What can you share with the audience about that?
I mean, Relentless Forward Progress is definitely focused on ultra marathon. No, it's a...
I blew it, and he loved the title. So maybe we should read...
Maybe I should... Edition 2.
Yeah.
Title, Relentless Forward Motion.
My apologies.
Same concept. Well, that's definitely focused on ultramarathons. That's what was driving me forward at the time, and that's what very clearly I Run Far's focus was, and still is to a high degree. But yeah, just sort of ultra marathon book felt appropriate in 2010 and 11. And as the sport grows, the need for sort of the prequel to Relentless Forward Progress, if you will. This is Where the Road Ends is for somebody getting into trail running, not necessarily looking to do an ultra marathon ever. This is somebody who's been hiking for years and maybe wants to take up running, or been mountain biking or climbing and wants to do something in their off season, or has been running the roads and kind of hears about these trail races and may have a 10 years of background of, you know, training and hitting the track and doing all the tempo runs, but doesn't know first thing about what they might need to carry for a 2-hour run in the mountains or how to navigate a trail system or that sort of thing. So it's, I wouldn't say it's just beginners, because it could be somebody with, you know, a decent amount of experience in a related outdoor activity, but bringing that them up to speed when it actually comes to trail running.
Absolutely. And if you look at some of the, in the table of contents, you know, hydration and fueling and techniques to match terrain, finding footing, there's all kinds of stuff that whether you're experienced or not, you're going to learn some of these golden nuggets and improve your game. That's what I took away from me.
You know, Brian, I think of, at least I imagine, you sitting down with Megan. You guys have a lot of experience on the trail, a lot of experience running. How do you come up with the perspective of someone that's just getting out on the trail? You know, what, there's a lot of things that people that have been running the trails for many, many years just take for granted, like the hydration or making sure you have a couple extra gel packs in your, you know, how did you get the perspective to write this book?
I mean, I think in part, it just, everything flowed logically, just sort of on the technique side, going from literally how do you run on different you know, substrates, whether it's, you know, rocky trails or flat trails or sandy trails, and then progressing that to, you know, if stuff's windy or rolling or muddy, and then putting that together into to longer segments, just thinking through from the small scale to the large scale for sort of all the, I mean, coming up with the major topics is easy enough. But then sort of bringing the logic together. And one of the great things was having the two of us, we definitely both wrote this, and having one catch, oh, well, we need to explain this little bit that the other person might have left out, and having the second set of eyes really critically looking for what needed to be said was awesome. Sometimes a painful experience, but
a little humbling sometimes.
So but it was also, I mean, there's literally stuff like in writing some of the techniques to match the train or some of the footing stuff. Like you have a mental concept or framework of what you think you're doing out there, but then like you put pen to paper, and you're like, all right, I'm going to go find that sort of muddy, snowy day and see if that's exactly what I'm doing out there. And then, you know, confirm that hypothesis.
I can also imagine that you and Megan are out on a morning run discussing the topics of the book and saying, okay, how can we explain this better? And, you know, how can I run uphill more effective? And you kind of can work on it while you're out on the trail.
Oh, that definitely happened. Yeah. There was a lot of, you know, going from concept to final framework out on the trail, testing.
Did you learn something as a trail runner from putting pen to paper?
I mean, I think it is like, I think I wrote more in the sort of technique kind of area, and just, it taught me, I got to take a really close look at what I was doing and seeing that, sort of, I don't know if I really changed anything, but it made me much more aware of what I was doing. And then, mm-hmm. you know, if I might get sloppy, mm-hmm. you know, late in Hard Rock in July, like, oh, well, maybe if you wouldn't be a dumbass, you can, you know, get some better traction. Like, just do what you wrote about.
Yeah, get back to the fundamentals. As,
exactly.
You know, everybody
totally.
Needs to do. Yeah.
Because I never got taught how to trail. I mean, the thing is like, if you're already a runner and you're out with friends on the trails, you might have a big group, and like people teach each other, and people taught me ultra running, but like there's lots of people who are, it might take their first steps out there alone, and to have somebody sort of explain the fundamentals could really help with that. If you're with some people, they can help teach you the trails, and that's great too.
Right.
As you approach this book, what would you say, or could you guess what is maybe one of the most common mistakes that someone makes as a transition from the road to the trail?
If they're doing the transition, it's probably the run everything mistake.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I see people who've been running ultras for years make that mistake. Yeah. I mean, there's definitely some of it. Sometimes it's a little bit of ego, but I think a lot of times it's just benign ignorance. They just, you know, I'm a runner. I'm out there running. I got to run everything. And there's plenty of times when you can go power hike and be more comfortable and more effective.
Yeah. I remember as I was being taught by and taken under the wing by other ultra runners, I would ask that question often. Should we run this? Or do you run this in this race? Or, you know, a 50-mile race or a 100-mile race? I was just trying to get into my game plan, what should be run and not run, until I learned to listen to my body more. I was just, like you said, well, we're running, we should just run this hill, but you fall over at the top when you do that.
I think we did the best we can to explain that in written word. And I mean, it's definitely a sliding scale. So there's not like, if it's this degree slope, walk. If this degree, I mean, like, cause it's your fitness, it's where your fitness is in that season. It's how long you're running for and how, like, if you're racing versus just, you know, 20-mile training run versus a 20-mile race, it's all different, but it's a process. And that's kind of showing people that you learn how to gauge what you're doing.
Hey, Brian, I want to get, and because probably no better person to ask than you, because you're really focused on this trail community and the sport itself. Where do you think this trail sport is going? As far as, is it expanding? Is it growing? Is it contracting? What's your opinion? And I, And I have a thread here based on something you said earlier. So I think this we could go somewhere with this topic.
I think it's expanding rapidly. It's somewhat interesting that I think there have been some, as with ultra running, there has been some spurts and pulses in the growth. It's all been an upward trend. It kind of jumps ahead and then slowly grows and jumps ahead. I'm not quite sure which of those two phases we're in right now, but we're sort of the more mature market because trail running of different lengths has been going on in the U.S. for quite a while. We're a well-off nation. People, you know, communities that want to have trail races tend to have at least some of them. Internationally, it's just gangbusters. Like the number of races and options and stuff that are getting added right now out, even in like mainland Europe, which has a long trail history, is just so quick and so fast. There's definitely not stopped here in the U.S., but it definitely pales in comparison to what's going on in Spain or China or Argentina or whatever. Those races just double every year, it feels like.
Wow. Which in your perspective and your travels, which do you see as the biggest growth country right now?
That's hard to say because some of the places are coming from such little trail running, but in places like China and South America are just they're starting from a small base, yeah, but growing really, really quickly. Just the number of races that are getting added in China every year that I know about, and that's obviously probably a terribly small fraction of their races is growing quickly.
I really like where you made a comment earlier about your first book, Relentless Progress.
Forward progress.
I'll get it straight. I have it in the other room. I need to bring it and put it on the table. That's what I need to do.
You want me to go get the...
would you? Yeah.
The prop.
There it is. Oh, but it's in Chinese.
But it's in Chinese. We can't read that. Why do you have a Chinese version of that book, Brian?
A journalist friend in Beijing suggested that he translate it, so he found a publisher and translated it into Mandarin.
No, I understand the reason why it's in Mandarin. I want to understand why you have one.
Oh, I never thought in my life I'd have a book that's published in Mandarin. So I was like, I was over in Hong Kong for the Hong Kong Be From Hong Kong 100 in January, and I'm like, I'm getting on Amazon China and I'm ordering 8 copies.
Heck yeah. That's funny. I'd also find a very good Mandarin speaking friend to make sure it wasn't altered in any way. Does it really say this right here? So I liked on your first book, you were at the time very, very focused on the ultra marathon. In fact, you're very successful yourself at competing. You've got top 10 finishes. You have an age group win at Western States what was it, 30 and under. And I've watched your race out there. You're very, very talented. You were focused on the ultra distance. And I'm curious and very interested in the fact that you've tailored this to welcome more people in, as trail running just isn't ultra running. It can be any distance and it doesn't have to be 50 miles. Just get out on the trail and move.
And it's awesome. I would encourage ultra runners, get out of your comfort zone and go run some short races.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're going to hurt more. It's like putting the frog in boiling water rather than cold water and slowly boiling it. But they're a lot of fun. I can't even think. Have I done an ultra this year? I've done 3 sub-ultra races, a 33K, a 29K, and a marathon on the trails.
Yeah.
I don't even know if I've done some marathon-length train or ultra-length training runs, but yeah, I'm blanking there, but I don't think I have. I mean, they're fun.
I like your term, sub-ultra.
I don't know what else to call it, marathon and shorter. If we're talking ultra runners, sub-ultra.
Yeah, there you go. And so I think it welcomes everyone to really enjoy the spirit of the trail and the community of the trail, the whole peace that all the ultra runners have been, you know, bathing in and in the luxury of the ultra community can be available at the 5K or at the 10K. It doesn't have to be, you know, 100K. You can still just get out there and do it.
If you live in a city, I mean, it's not quite what we would call trail running, but go try a cross-country race. You know, folks did in, you know, high school and college. I did, and I loved it. And a lot of cities still have a couple race cross-country series. And you'd be running around a golf course rather than, you know, some mountain single track. But you're off road and it's a hoot.
So I think we'll see more and more of the shorter race. I just spoke to a trail runner this morning that's going for a 10-mile race that's this Saturday, and I thought, you know, that's welcoming to just about everyone out there, and that's good. I see more of those popping up, is what I've seen. What about the 200-mile race? Now that's an extension. Now we're going from one end of the bell curve to the other.
We're going to from sub ultra to mega ultra.
I was definitely very skeptical about the 200-mile distance. I'll admit it. I was in theory. I'm like, why do we? I mean, the 100's enough. 100 miles is enough. Like, what else do you have to prove? Are you just bored running 100 miles? Is more better? And then I saw Megan Hicks, my girlfriend and co-worker here at I Run Far. She did Tour de Géant, which is 206 miles, and just saw her suffer terribly with like sleep deprivation. I'm like, this is really stupid. I can confirm that. I want to say it one more time before I, you know, say anything publicly, because I'd like to have a, you know, you have a gut opinion and reactions, and then sort of I want to have a mature opinion about it. And then I did Ultra Trail Gobi Race, 250 miles self-navigation in the Gobi last September, and it was awesome.
Really?
It was completely blown away by how much I enjoyed the experience.
Tell us about it. Why did you enjoy it so much, and when did skepticism turn to support?
I think it was, I mean, for one, I saw Megan suffer from sleep deprivation, so I was determined to get a lot of rest. The first two nights of the race, I slept full nights, like 7+ hours, and that was I was there to have an enjoyable experience. I think in the 11 weeks before the race, I averaged 15 miles a week because of work, of training. So just went into enjoying it, and just I was going out there to finish it. And then very early on, I sort of found myself running next to Betsy Kallmeyer, many, many, many time winner of Hard Rock, awesome person who I met casually a couple times, interviewed once. But we ended up running the first 2 days of the race together, just kind of chatting away sometimes, quiet sometimes, keeping each other in check. And it just started the whole process out nice and calm. And yeah, by day three, like things were still easy and still good. Like the effort's even lower than a 100-mile race. That eating, I never had any problem eating. And at 10 of the 33 checkpoints, we could have like a drop bag with, so I'd have a camping meal at each of those 10 checkpoints and other real food, some cookies, some nuts, whatever, just a Coca-Cola. And it just, you can fuel, I got sleep, and it was just this sublime experience where you're just moving forward. I was just over 4 days for me, and I really enjoyed that. It's a time when like you really just can't think about, or I wasn't thinking about outside life most of the time. I mean, at least in terms of work and stresses and that kind of stuff. So it's just a great time to be moving and maybe reflecting more broadly.
So tell me about effort level. You know, we know what the effort level is, say for, you know, a 10K, and then you can picture yourself your effort level that you need to maintain for a marathon. And you go up the ladder, 50 mile, 100 mile. What effort level did you go into the 206 mile effort with?
Yeah, it was 250, but
250. Yeah. Let me correct that.
Megan ran the 206. Yeah. He was running 250.
Yeah. Oh,
and there's a difference. The answer varies.
It's shorter, but her race is shorter, but way, way tougher. I would not run Tour de Géant. It's just beyond my mental level right now. But in the Gobi race, like I kind of felt with 100 milers, or even on training runs, have an all day pace that I kind of know. And it's effort. It's not based on speed.
Sure.
And I kind of just felt like it was pretty similar for the 200 miler. Cause I was sleeping the first couple nights. I mean, it was just, if you can't talk comfortably to the person next to you, which was great to have Betsy there for, if you can't talk, you're going too hard. If you're pushing a certain muscle group, you're going too hard. I kind of have chronic Achilles and calf issues that, not the slightest of inclines, but any time we did hit a hill, I was walking, or if it was a marathon straight across the desert, I'd probably be running most of it, but every 20 minutes, take a 15 second walk break. Not that I was timing it or anything, but just being conscious of, you have to use this very similar muscle group and motion for 4 days. Just give it a little break.
Yeah.
Fortunately, I didn't have any problems in terms of, this muscle or that muscle breaking down for a long period. There were definitely, one thing that ultra running teaches you, if you've been doing it a while, is that, things are going to go wrong, but often enough, they correct themselves. Like, maybe my hip flexor on one side would be a little bothering me for a couple hours, and then I'd check back in on it later and it wouldn't be. And then it would be some other muscle, for a couple hours the next morning, or my calves might be tight the next morning or whatever. And just knowing enough to kind of ignore that. If something was going to become acute, it'd be constant and progress in the wrong direction. But just staying relaxed, not worrying.
You've had the opportunity to go around the world and watch and participate in many of these races. This is a two-part question. I like two-part questions, Don. Mm-hmm. First part is, what's the most beautiful trail race you've ever run? And then the other one is, what is the top bucket list trail race that you'd like to run?
I think that it's hard with what's the most beautiful race, because it changes based on what race I did last. I just did a 30K in sort of Western Sichuan province, the start of the Tibetan Plateau in China. And it was just, the mountain at the top of that was just stunning. And then the race before that, or a couple races ago, was in sort of the Southern Alps of New Zealand. And they were stunning. So there's just so many fantastic locales for races. Like, people start complaining that this race or that race sells out. Get out there and find something, because there's a million, just an endless supply of breathtakingly beautiful races out there. Just forget about the always having to have the most historical or the most important quote unquote race, and just find what type of terrain excites you and go do it.
Brian, that's a really, really a great point. Some people get so bummed out and their season is just disrupted because they, didn't get signed up in time, or they didn't get in the lottery. But you're right. There are just so many places, so many locations that will just be all of a sudden become, like you said, your newest favorite.
The Bear 100 is, it sells out now, but the Bear is just stunningly beautiful. And I've never run the Bighorn 100, and I'd love to run that someday. It's kind of hard because it's just behind before Western States, and mm-hmm. it just would be tough with work. But there's tons of races like that in the U.S. In terms of like a bucket race list, I don't know if I have a name of one, but I'd really love to go to Iceland someday. So some random, they're actually, I sort of know the name of some, but I'm not even going to try to pronounce them. But some 50K in Iceland in July sounds pretty, it'd be a pretty good trip to me.
It seems like runners are traveling all over the globe now. And I don't know if it's just because social media and I can see that they are, or has there been quite a shuffle of, European runners coming here and American runners going there? And what, do you have any thoughts on that?
I think it's two parts, like on the sort of front end of the field, the very front of the field, like over the last 5 years, more athletes have been, flown or invited or whatever, assisted in traveling to races around the world, whether it's the, very most competitive race or just a race that wants some exposure. And as a result of that, a lot of folks around the US and the world, sort of just normal runners like myself and you guys, like, we see it on social media, and that's, mm-hmm. that's what the races hope for. But then you sort of see, oh, this race in New Zealand is awesome, or there's something to see in Iceland. I mean, I've probably seen enough photos for runners taking some sort of top runners or influencers or whatever taking trips to Iceland that I kind of get the itch to go there. And I think, in a good way, social media gives us the exposure to new experiences. So,
speaking of the itch to go somewhere, trail porn. Talk us a little bit about that.
What kind of itch are you talking about there, Don?
Well, I'm going to let Brian answer that.
Yeah, so trail porn is just like a side project of myself, I guess. I mean, it's on the sidebar of I Run Far, and it's just, I don't know, I thought for years and years and years it would be awesome to have just a sort of inspirational photo outlet. I had the domain for goodness knows how long and just didn't find a good platform for sharing the actual material. And I wish I actually spent more time on it and put photos up every day or every other day. Readers can submit photos to Trail Porn. And it's just, I love seeing a great photo of a trail, whether there's a runner in it or not, just something that inspires me. And we've all, you know, seen that. I think the term I first saw, I mean, sometimes I have a little regret of using the term porn, but it's a term that's been co-opted. There's bike porn and cabin porn, and it's past the point of being associated with necessarily with lewd content to just being sort of eye-opening, inspiring stuff. So,
I enjoy looking through there because I know that through that lens is one of that runner's favorite views or spot that they would want to take you to and share with you. Like, this is my favorite trail. This is my once I get to the top, here's what I see. And it's like taking an instant look into another runner's favorite place.
Mm-hmm.
So that's I like, and there's some very talented photographers out there, you know.
Totally. Yeah. We're lucky to Megan and I to know folks through our work with I Run Far, like Alexi Berg, who published this awesome coffee table book, Grand Trail. Sharing some of his work from the book on trail porn at the moment. And we've had stuff like that in the past. It's just awesome to bring both amateur photographers and some of the best in the world and share their work, inspire folks.
That's one of the questions I wanted to ask you as I was reading through the book. You've got some great pictures in there. And are those from you? Did you get people to submit them? I mean, how do you come across these pictures?
It's interesting. I think a majority of there's a inside the, not the front cover, but the next page, there's a list of all the photographers' credits. I would actually guess that a majority of the book is probably Megan, or close to majority is Megan and myself, along with Kirsten Cordebine, a friend of ours who did a photo shoot down here. So a lot of the technical stuff is her work. But then, yeah, we also sort of wanted to bring on another level of photos with some of them. So approach some of our professional friends. And then there's a couple photos where we needed X or Y specific photo and went searching for somebody that might have it, an acquaintance who might have a photo of a rattlesnake or a mountain lion or whatever. Just, yeah.
So Brian, you've been actively involved in the trail community and have a passion for it that just oozes out of your pores. I'm trying to remember how long have you been doing I Run Far? When did that start?
I guess technically it started in like what I Run Far is today, October 2007. It had been existing as a personal running blog since like late 2006. Became sort of informational source in 2007, and then full time since May 2009. So I haven't checked on the date, but it's right around the 7-year anniversary of doing this full time.
So, you know, for those maybe that don't know the story, you're an attorney headed towards Washington, D.C. for a successful career. And all of a sudden you decide to change direction. And is that when I Run Far opened up in 2009 or 7 to become much more? Or where does that lie in the timeline?
I mean, I became got out of law school in 2006. So I was an attorney during all of the first years of I Run Far. I think it was just under 3 years where I was an attorney, working on I Run Far sort of on the side, whether it was just my personal running blog or, you know, doing a little bit more in the evenings. And then I just didn't end up enjoying the whole attorney thing so much and thought I Run Far might be a bridge to something else, and then eventually it just became a bridge to I Run Far.
Yeah, yeah. If I had to weigh the benefits of being an attorney and then running of I Run Far and traveling to exotic places and reporting on races and trying gear and reporting on it. I think that might be my choice. I think you chose well.
Thanks. And there's definitely ups and downs and benefits to both scenarios. I definitely want to encourage everybody who has a good normal job that they enjoy to continue if they can get the running in they like during the week and it affords them the opportunity to go fly to races and not have to work for that full week. You know, actually take vacations and enjoy it and immerse yourself. Go for that. Whatever makes you happy.
I think you invented the genre of getting a tripod and interviewing a racer right before the race. I mean, that not on, the day before the race, where you ask them very, very poignant questions about strategy or about their path to get to that race. And that's when I first became exposed to Brian, is mm-hmm. seeing all these, he's interviewing Anton or Jeff Rose or whomever, I think that's, I think you own that space.
Yeah. I have no idea how that started. I think the first interview I did was maybe Anton. I must've been maybe Trail Runner magazine. Like I'd been writing a little bit for them and maybe I think they just wanted an interview with him around Leadville 1 year. So I did it and I guess I've been doing it ever since. That was kind of an assignment, interview for them. And then it just went from there.
It wasn't like you guys were set up in a studio or even, some fold out chairs or anything. You're just standing and sometimes there's people walking back behind you. I just like the setting because it was so casual and real.
It is. I mean, like that, part of that's unintentional and part of that's just circumstance. I mean, I think the intentional part is there's lots, we interview the Killians or the Francois Dehaenes or the Rob Krars enough times. They're comfortable doing interviews, but then somebody jumps on a podium who's never been in front of a camera before. And
yeah.
If we were miking them up and putting them in a studio-ish setting, might be a little more intimidating if it's just the two of us standing there in front of a high school gym wall talking about what runners talk about. I feel that's a lot more relaxed. And then a lot of times it's just a matter of they're busy people fitting an interview with us into the day. So we meet where they can and kind of try to find a place that's not busy and not noisy. It's a lot harder at the finish line because mm-hmm. plenty of times that person's taken off at 6 the next morning and kind of have to find a place that's more quiet than right at the finish line. But it's not like we can go a mile away to some quiet little park and do an interview. So,
well, as the viewer, you feel like you've just stepped into a three-way conversation instead of, watching something more removed. So I think it's good. Yeah. Yeah.
One of the things I like about, I Run Far and how it's developed over the years is you have some really cool partners that have joined up with you. Been lucky enough to talk with many of them, AJW, with Ian Torrance, that multiple times, and they have columns on there that they, I guess it's weekly. Is it weekly? Most of them are weekly.
Weekly or monthly? Yeah, it depends on who.
How did that evolve, and how is that working out for you?
It's interesting, yeah. Because now I think back, and at one point, everything on I Run Far was pretty much me. I was writing everything, which was a stage in its evolution. I want to say that if AJW wasn't the first, and he might not have been, but I remember having a conversation about a brew pub when I was out at UROC 1 year and just having a couple beers and talking about him wanting a column and just us exploring the idea. And he'd been a friend there. I'd paced him out at some races and seen him other places. And like I said, I paced him in a couple of races at that point. And he expressed an interest and it sounded like a good idea. So he's been doing it ever since. And I thought that added a lot. And then more and more through the years, I felt that having that diversity of voices and opinions and insights is super important to I Run Far. And I love it. And it's something now that Megan and I, are very conscientious to maintain and to encourage. And I think it's interesting that we've got to the point of longevity with having sort of set columnist that we've now seen things evolve, not go through one full iteration of columnists, but Jeff Rose recently decided to retire from the column for a while. Well, I wouldn't say we'll never see I could see another Jeff Rose piece here and there, but other people like Dakota was writing every other week and now he writes once a month. We've added a ton of new columnists through time. We have, I guess I can share, we have two new columnists in the coming month or so. My very good friend Eliza LaPierre will be joining us for a monthly column. And I'm nervous to say it because I don't know if it'll actually happen, but supposedly I'm supposed to have a column starting starting next month. It's interesting because all the writing I do now is feels to me like it's writing, you know, race previews, race results, that kind of thing.
Do you have to get permission from Megan to have your own column? Is that the reason why?
I just got to put it on paper and commit to it just because I've been so busy for so many years and wanted to write more. But occasionally, very rarely, I've put like a race report or a similar report on I Run Far, but I haven't had a lot of chance to share my, or yeah, an outlet really to share my own opinions. So kind of figure.
I hope that negotiation with yourself goes well and we'll get to see that.
Well, we'll see if I actually, you'll know next month if there's actually an article for me or not, other than a Western States preview or the like.
Hey, so who came up with the whole idea of the tap room? You know, we talk about that every time Andy's on
That's AJW, 100%.
Was the tap room in existence before I Run Far, or is that an I Run Far generated bar?
AJW inspired I Run Far supported bar, for sure. Because I guess the part of the concept of the column is having topics or articles that someone could, you know, after having run with your buddies on a Friday night, could sit down and, you know, with a beer or a root beer or a glass of ice cold water, whatever you want, you know, just sort of sit around in a comfortable atmosphere and chat about or do it on the trails. But yeah, just discussion pieces, thought provokers, that kind of thing. And obviously his love for beer kind of played. Yeah. But
we have a fun time with that. We always act as if it really exists. And
hey, what? What?
It does exist.
Yeah, it does.
In Andy's mind. Hey, I have a question about the book. How long does it take to put a book like that together? You sit down and you start to finish. What time frame does it take to put this together? And just to let people know, we're talking about a 226-page book.
That makes me want to cry a little bit. it was about, I want to say, I mean, it's a year and a half, 20 months, something like that, from sort of Megan working with a publisher to decide the scope of the book and get a contract and that kind of thing, and then to having it in print. There was definitely six to eight months that most of the book was written. But then there's multiple iteration. There's sort of like an editing set of revisions, and then there's a couple series of sort of proof and copywriting type revisions, and then there's collecting photos and placing photos and captions and all that little stuff. So
I couldn't imagine the proofreading. I can't even put together 140 character text on Twitter without having three errors in it, and 226 pages, no chance.
Well, we'll see how that turns. You haven't. I don't want to open that Pandora's box, so I have not done a close read of the final version at this point, because I don't want to be like, oh my goodness, they misspelled Megan's name on page 3 or something.
you know, but, this doesn't have anything to do with trail running, but I'm very interested in this, so I'm going to ask it anyway.
Yeah.
When you're doing this, I always assume that in my mind, because I've written many books in my mind, no, I haven't, that you go in and you write everything, and then you just submit it. and the and there's an editor at the publisher that goes through and says, you know what, this sentence doesn't sound real well, rework it, or we'll rework it for you, and here's some spelling. They go through the book with a red pen, and then they say, you know what, we need to get some photos, so we're going to go out and get some, and they do all of that work. All you do is the writing, but it sounds like you have control over pretty much everything, right?
I would not say full control. There was definitely little issues that we yielded to the publisher on. Lots of back and forth on titles, and I can't remember. There was a couple other things that, yeah, we definitely wanted X and they wanted Y, and publisher wins in that scenario.
Usually. Of course, yeah.
Not in terms of content. We never had that in terms of, like, we want you to promote this kind of, you know, 4 foot running is the only way our publisher will, you know, our publishing house discusses technique. No, but in terms of the written content, they were very deferential. Good in terms of, can you clarify this? This doesn't quite read right. That kind of editorial suggestions. But yeah, the substance of the book is what Megan and I wanted. But there we had, yeah, a huge role in that also, because every time we'd submit and they'd give changes, at least for the first couple revisions, like, we were also making our own revisions at that point, because having space from writing an initial draft really helps.
How about an audio version? I mean, heck, yeah. Relentless Forward Progress is in Mandarin. And so if you've done that, what about audio versions? Are they available? And when does that become an option? And how does that work?
I have never talked to either publisher about that. You got any ideas on who should read it? Who should we have?
AJW, probably.
If I didn't say AJW, probably. Yeah,
Robert De Niro. Robert De Niro.
Jack Nicholson.
I think Morgan Freeman would probably give Relentless Forward Progress a good feel.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I'm actually, Don and I are both listening to a book that's it's a business book. And it's read by the two authors. And it's kind of neat. One chapter, one of the guys reads, and then the next chapter, the other guy reads. It's actually, and I like that.
Yeah.
Still, I think Bill Bryson might do his own readings for audiobooks. I might be
wrong.
I
think Into the Woods, I think he read his own.
I think he did in Sunburn Country, too, which I've listened to on some runs.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of audiobooks. Just note, if I sit down long enough to read a book, I find myself falling asleep. I need to pump stuff into my ears, and it helps me, especially
when
I'm out there
running. Well, I got to do some research here. I got hard rock training, and that's going to mean some up and down some hills for endless time in the next couple weeks. Give me your top audiobook recommendation that's not running. Oh.
That's not running.
I'll tell you this one. That Don turned me on to. I've gotten sucked in really, really quick, and that is it's called
Extreme
Ownership,
right?
And it's a business book of these two Navy SEALs that use battle type experiences and equate that into business. It's really good.
Cool. Well, I'll have to check that out someday when doing Kendall Mountain repeats in Silverton.
Anything by Daniel Silva is also very good.
Daniel Silva. All right, I'm taking notes here.
Yeah, Daniel Silva is one of my favorites. He has a whole series about Gabriel Allon, who's a international spy.
Ooh, I haven't done a lot of true fiction on audiobook. I tend to listen to a lot of nonfiction. I guess Bill Bryson is kind of on the edge, but it still reads like nonfiction or listens like nonfiction, but it'd be fun to listen to some just fun reads out on the trail.
Yeah. 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 This is just, you kind of have to pay attention. It's not mindless. You got to pay attention, but it's fun.
Cool. Teeth falling on it while I'm listening carefully to the plot downhill.
So where is Megan right now? We didn't get her on the podcast, and you told me she was in a plane somewhere. Where is she headed, and what's she doing?
She's texting me right now of all the timing. She is in Atlas Tubkalgite, which is a tiny village above Imlil in the Atlas Mountains in Morocco. So
okay, I heard Morocco. That's the only word that made sense in that. What is she doing in Morocco? Is she working or is she running?
Or both? Running.
Oh, nice.
She's there for a couple weeks. She didn't, unfortunately, was not able to run the Marathon de Sable this year, which is kind of one of her true loves. and she, but she was over for Transvolcania a week ago to report on that in the Canary Islands. And then it just kind of worked out that her friends from the Marathon de Sable put on this Trans Atlas stage race in a couple weeks. So she's over there sort of training in the Atlas Mountains for a couple weeks. And then she will run this stage race at the end of the month before heading back this way.
The benefits of I Run Far and not being in a cubicle somewhere.
So, I mean, like, that's the thing is, like, a lot of times when we're off doing these things, like when I was just in Tibet, I was up at 11:30 at night trying to get the internet connection to work to edit this or that, or on a, you know, phone call at 5:45 in the morning to make things happen. And then during the day I'm having fun, but yeah, Megan will be, she'll definitely be working over there. I hope to take a little load off her plate if I can, but, she's still in contact most of that time.
Hey, before we close here, and one of the things we opened up with was talking about the I Run Far's coverage on races and how superior, really, the you've set the mark for that. How do you pull that off? How many people are out on the course? How do you communicate when you're out there in a mountain somewhere and you're trying to, at mile 49, call back and update the position of racers?
It's like making laws or making sausage. You just don't want to know most of the time. No, I mean, it can literally be, there's plenty of times when it's just me, say at Les Templiers in France. There's plenty of times where for that race, there's always been a local driver who knows exactly how long it takes to get from X to Y. So I don't have to think about that. I just say, I need to go to X next, and he tells me exactly when we have to leave. And I get enough cell coverage that I can just put that out. But then there's a race like Hard Rock where we might have, I was just looking at the chart the other day, thinking about this year, and I'm sure we had 15 to 20 people helping out with sat phones and sat modems and cell phones and manual reports at times. Just like most of that coming back to a central hub somewhere, so that somebody at a computer in a dry, safe environment can share that with the world. But it definitely it scales, depends on the race and upon the ease of walking around or of getting around the course. I mean, there's some races that are very easy to sort of one or two people to get from one point to the next and report on the race. And then, I mean, Hard Rock, I probably did it the first year by myself or something like that. And it just meant being at, you know, four or five places and having to cut, you know, leave after the third woman and to make the top guy at the next play, you know, that's 25 miles away, you know, 25 miles down the course. It's just balancing that depending on how many people and we have and what the race really dictates and warrants.
Yeah. Well, you've got a strong reputation there. I was following a race and somebody said, well, the website says this, but I Run Far just reported this. So I'm going with that.
I mean, and that we try to do that. I mean, like, you'll very, very rarely will we fill in information based on just reports from the race itself, unless we're pretty sure that they're correct, because race tracking systems make mistakes. Volunteers who might not know ultra running might, you know, miss the number one at the front of a bib or something like that, and all of a sudden some random guy's in the lead, and we're like, no, we're pretty sure Killian's still ahead by an hour.
Don Freeman didn't pass Killian today.
and Mike Foot and Smeals. Yeah, you didn't run by all of those going up handies.
No.
So having some experience and knowing who's in these races really, really helps in that regard.
Brian Powell, we're looking at your book and Megan Hicks' book, Where the Road Ends, A Guide to Trail Running, available from I Run Far website. I saw it there. And I'm sure just about Google will tell you where to find it. Where's the best place for you for people to pick this book up?
I think in this time of year, probably on Amazon. I mean, not on Amazon, on our website, on I Run Far. There's in the navigation, there'll be a thing for new book, and you can just click on that, and it'll take you to a page with information about the book and how to order it. With Megan being in Morocco right now, if you want an autograph by both of us, it'd be a couple weeks, but... we keep track of those things, and I mean, if you want to get the cheapest copy, you can go to Amazon or another online retailer. If you want to support your local, you know, local bookstore or running store or outdoor retailer, go buy local. Whatever works for you.
Or I'd say support your local author and buy directly from the website. Get that autograph. And Brian, go ahead.
I was going to say, if you haven't gone to irunfar.com, you should go there. There's a lot of just really cool stuff, good information, fun content, gear reviews, videos.
Trail porn.
I mean, there's all sorts of stuff. You can also see them on Facebook and Twitter. Does irunfar have an Instagram account, or is that just the trail porn Instagram?
Yeah, no Instagram.
Okay, so trail porn has Instagram, though.
I think the only reason I have trail porn Instagram is because you can only put photos on Strava for a bit with an Instagram account. We don't have it. Trail porn is pretty much... There's trailporn.com, or it's in the sidebar of irunfar itself.
Well, Brian Powell, thank you for all you do for the trail community and for putting the resources together and allow us to follow races and become better racers ourselves. And your work is recognized and appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a great time.
Absolutely. So go out and run.
Moth.